From Cape Town, this is the Voice of the Cape. The Voice of the Cape. The Voice of the Cape.
The Legal Hour with Ihsan Higgins.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Ihsan Higgins here with the Legal Hour. And as usual, we have our resident guests, you know, as I would call them by now. We have none other than Attorney Faisal Bardin. Assalamu alaikum, Faisal.
Wa alaikum salam, Ihsan, and to all the Voice of the Cape listeners.
And then we have Attorney Nazir Park, who's also not a stranger to this program. Assalamu alaikum, Nazir.
Wa alaikum salam, Ihsan, and to the listeners of the Voice of the Cape.
Yeah, tonight we're doing, it's a general program, so I'm inviting listeners to send in their WhatsApps, you know, with any questions that they may have that's been niggling, that they've been bothered with, you know, and can't seem to get an answer from anyone. Because we all know there's a whole lot of lawyers out there. Everybody seems to want to give advice, but not necessarily the right advice. Tonight we have the two lawyers here and myself, and we will answer all the questions that we were hoping to answer all the questions. But more specifically tonight, you know, for the lawyers and for the listeners, we're dealing with the topic of business, partners, deals, and sharks. And I mean, people are very used to saying that that person is a shark or that person is not a shark, and so we're gonna learn tonight a little bit about who's who in the zoo. So Faisal, business, you know, we've seen a whole lot of the issues that we've seen with business people. You know, I mean, that's what lawyers do. You know, they deal with problems, especially with, well, of course, it's the family side, but then there's, of course, the business side. The business deals that people enter into, why is it that in our community we still have people entering into deals and giving money to each other or borrowing or lending money without entering into proper contracts?
Yeah, I think, son, you know, we talk a lot on the radio station about family matters and, you know, related to that. And we don't talk enough maybe about, you know, this topic we have today on business transactions and business itself and, you know, the pitfalls and things like that. So I think maybe it's time we talk a bit about that, and we'll keep it as simple as possible and the listeners can send in their questions. But I think what we want to do to just kick off is that I just thought we will talk about the different types of business structures in South Africa. Mm-hmm. Just to give a very brief, we're not going to go into depth about it.
Faisal, you must bear in mind we're going to break for a shy in about 2 minutes.
Yeah, so maybe I'll just mention the different structures quickly and we can discuss it afterwards or people can ask questions about it. So the business structures are basically... you know, mentioned in the Companies Act or regulated by the Companies Act, and the different types of structures in South Africa is the one which is a sole proprietor, which everybody knows out there is a person who trades on his own in his name. He has a small business, and that how he submits his taxes, etc., and carries on the business in a sole proprietorship, and that's very straightforward, simple. The other one is a partnership, is that where there's maybe two to a maximum of 20 people who get together and they form a partnership, and there we normally recommend you must do a partnership agreement. Don't enter into a partnership and just do an oral agreement amongst 20 people or 10 people or 5 or even 2 people, mm-hmm. and you don't record your partnership in writing who does what and who deals with finances and who.
And Faisal, probably because they don't record things in writing, they start accusing people of being a scallum.
That's where the problem starts. So your partnership agreement, go to an attorney, get the attorney to consult with you and draft that partnership agreement, you know, discuss it and the terms so you understand what role each partner plays in that partnership.
Okay. Nazir, just one comment before we're going to give over to the technician.
Well, Sean, I think just coming back to your question, why do people not enter into agreements? I think they still have that old mindset in place where the shake of the hand was as good as a guarantee. Unfortunately, these days you see it more and more in the courtrooms where and that principle doesn't apply any longer, and I think people need to commit Okay. Business relationships to agreements.
Nazir, I'm going to quiz you a lot on the types of agreements, you know, that people refuse to enter into, and I'm hoping that people will sit and we'll deal with things like the sureties, we'll deal with things like the sessions, we'll deal with a lot of other things.
Live from Cape Town, this is the Voice of the Cape, 91.3 FM.
The Legal Hour with Ihsan Higgins.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. After Isha Salah, and we are back with the Legal Hour. I've got with me Faisal Bardin and Nazir Parker, and we're speaking about business, partners, deals, and sharks. And we're dealing with various entities, what type of companies, why people should be getting into, you know, contracts, you know, especially when there's money involved. And basically to lessen the risk to people. Faisal, you were still talking about different entities?
The types of business structures in South Africa. Before the break, I mentioned the sole proprietorship and the partnership, and how important the partnership agreement is if you are forming a partnership between two or more partners. Remember, you can only have up to 20 people as in a partnership. And the next one is private companies. I think that's the most common used one at the moment. It's a Pty Limited, where you see those words in as letters in brackets, Pty Limited. And there you would have a director, and you would have, well, maybe more than one director, and you will have shareholders who own the shares of a company. So that's quite a common type of business structure that many companies use in South Africa. And you need to, you know, when you are trading with other parties, you need to inform that other party that you are Pty Limited. So in all your stationery, you know, you need to put it out there that you are Pty Limited. And then you get your public companies. That's which is your listed, not listed company, companies who offer shares to the general public to raise capital. And there you would have also a minimum of about three directors and a minimum of one shareholder. That company, the private company, will just add LTD, you know, behind its name, and you know that's a public company. The next one is a personal liability companies, and that type of companies are where the directors are basically liable for the actions of the company, and very common use of those type of companies would be attorneys and accountants, etc., who have personal liability companies, and they call them incorporated companies. And then you get your state-owned companies, your state-owned enterprises. Those are the government-owned companies, which we all know about out there. And last but not least is your non-profit companies. And your non-profit companies are basically established to form, you know, your social activities, your communal groups, non-profit entities who go out there and serve the community out there. So all the profits that you gain from this company goes back into the communities. You can't pay out shareholders. You can, however, pay salaries to the workers of that
administrative expenses.
That's right, yeah. So that's just a list of the companies. And just lastly, closed corporations, you know, since May 2011, you no longer can register closed corporations. However, the existing closed corporations at that point in time could still operate, and they are still closed corporations operating today, but you cannot register new closed corporations.
So your best option would be to register a company?
The Pty, yes.
Mm. Nazir, we just wanted to check with you quickly. I mean, there's a whole lot of other issues that bad faith between partners. I mean, people normally end up with partners, and then of course something happens, you know, somebody feels that they've been shortchanged, and then of course this leads to bad faith. What's the best options for people that just enter into a partnership?
Sean, firstly, you need to make sure that you have a properly structured partnership agreement. Everybody and all the partners, whether it be 2 to 20, as Faisal has explained, must be 100% sure of what they are going to achieve in this partnership, what the consequences will be, if there's losses, what the consequences will be, because it's in partnerships you're going to share together and you're going to lose together. So it must be, it's critical that the partnership agreement has all the necessary T's and C's in it, especially when it comes to one partner maybe, like you said it earlier, maybe being a little bit underhanded in his
okay.
dealings.
Okay, Nazir, it brings me to this. In fact, I'm just thinking about this now. Now, when a husband and a wife, let's assume the husband and a wife is only married Islamically, and they buy a house together, would it not be prudent then to also enter into a partnership agreement in respect of this particular house?
It would be. They are partners. In that sense, in a commercial sense, they are partners. So it would be important for the husband and the wife, if especially the only married Sharia-wise, until such time that the legislation may change in the near future, that they enter into properly constructed partnership agreements. Because what happens in the event of a divorce? Who's going to be receiving benefits and who's going to put in more, who's going to get out what they put in? You know, there's so many pros and cons.
Yeah, there's always an issue. You know, I paid the rates, water, electricity, and I paid the bond. How do we then calculate?
I spent 200,000 rand to improve the property, so on and so forth.
So the partnership agreement could deal with those type of issues.
But now, why is it that, I've been in practice, we've all been in practice for a while. It doesn't really happen.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't happen. I think the people, when they purchase the property, they think if they purchase it in 50-50, they think that's sufficient. I own a 50% share. You know, I'm covered, I'm secured, but it doesn't deal with the nitty-gritty things.
In the event of death, all
those things. And even if you buy together and you perhaps going to buy it as an investment and you're going to rent out the property, you must deal with those type of issues. You know, who's going to collect the rent? What you're going to use the rent for? Are you going to pay the bond? Or are you going to pay maintenance? Are you going to pay, you know, those type of things?
Also, and I'm thinking of siblings, children. Let's say they've inherited a property and they also got shares in that particular property. Now, in the if they had a partnership agreement in respect of that property, it will avoid the uncomfortable issues that will arise later. Let's say three siblings on one property. Now, one of the siblings, the daughter is getting married, and they need a place to stay. Then that sibling will say, yeah, but you know what, I have a share in this property, but can my daughter stay there? Now the other two siblings, they don't want to cause problems within that family by saying no, because then it's of course a groot kilaaf afge. But if they had a partnership agreement, then possibly that eventuality could have been dealt with.
I agree. You know, funny that you mentioned that kind of an example, Hassan. I'm actually busy with a matter of a very similar nature. Where the children, four children inherited a property, three girls, one boy. Boy inherited a 40% and the 60% was divided amongst the three girls, 20-20-20. The girl is not living, one of the females are living in the property now. It's causing all sorts of conflict because nobody actually took the time and did what you're suggesting now, is to enter into an agreement so everybody understands their rights and obligations towards the property. Now the one in the property is being the targeted one by everybody else. So it happens.
I'm testing the theory because, I mean, it's not normal. I mean, it's not normal for people to do that, but it could become the new normal.
Yeah. Look, it's like you mentioned, especially if there's inheritance and there's three parties, and the one party is going to continue living in the property, and the one party who's living in the property might not have any other accommodation, was living with a parent at the time, and when the parent passed away, continue living in the property, that party might not have sufficient income to pay rental. So there's all those type of issues that come into play. However, unfortunately, there's some individuals in that co-ownership who gets disadvantaged because the party who's living in the property is only benefiting from that property.
It's unfortunate also, sorry to interrupt you, Sandra, it's unfortunate also that when the father or the mother that does the will also doesn't specify but more in terms of...
But I don't want to go into the realm of inheritance. I'm talking about specifically... of co-ownership, you know, where people have a co-ownership of property, and if there's a document up front that will stipulate various scenarios in future, then of course there's going to be less problems in that family.
I agree.
Okay. And also, if you say up front, it doesn't mean also now at this stage you can't enter into that. So if you inherited the property 3, 4, 5 years ago, and you feel that, listen, we want to do now the agreement, you can still do it.
Yes, you're even between a husband and a wife.
Yeah, you can still do that agreement, and, you know, to avoid future problems.
Okay, that's fine. And then the second thing is, but before I just jump off there, of course, when one does divorces, you have a lot of problems. You know, when there's a husband and wife owning a property, and of course, then they always fight about who gets the half share, you know, the other party. And if a partnership agreement can deal with that up front, you know, that either the one party pays out the other party or vice versa, or they sell it to a third party.
Mm.
But in that way, you know, it can just avoid a whole lot of problems.
Mm.
But let's get back to some of these deals. Now, sureties, big problem in our community.
Mm.
Big problem is for South Africans. You know, you have creditors that demand, oh, no, I will not give you this loan, you need a surety. And a lot of people, they end up signing a surety, not even knowing what they're signing. Faisal, take us through the first part of surety. Nazir, I want you to comment on it as well.
Yeah, well, if you can avoid signing a surety, avoid signing it. You know, that's you know, that's the first point, if you can. Especially, say, for instance, you got a family member, and a family member comes to you and says, listen, I need to enter into this contract, but they're looking for a surety agreement. And with what it basically means, if that person doesn't perform, you're going to be responsible for that person's non-performance, and you financially you're going to be tied to that agreement.
But, yeah, but there's a bigger problem. I mean, sometimes you can, then the creditor can come directly to the surety.
Yes, no, that's what I'm saying. So if the debtor fails to perform, they can look to the surety to claim that outstanding amount, whether it is a rental, you know, or whether it's a loan or whatever the case may be. So the surety must be aware that, you know, you're signing it. It's not just, you know, signing the agreement, nothing can go wrong here. The debtor will
things
comply.
Will go wrong.
There is a huge possibility that things can go wrong, and then you are liable in terms of that surety agreement. So that's the first point. And we said, if you can avoid. So there are instances where you cannot avoid it.
Yes.
For instance, if you going to take out a loan in the name of a company or a bond in the name of a company, and you're the director of the company, the bank is going to ask you to sign a surety, you know, on behalf of the company, on the performance of the company. And if the company fails, you then would be personally liable, as if it was a personal liability company, as I mentioned earlier, in which attorneys and accountants operate, because they are personally liable for the transactions they conclude with the public out there.
But Nazir, there's certain instances where a young person wants to rent a property, and then the landlord insists, you know, that your parents must be surety. What would you advise those parents in that instance?
Well, son, unfortunately, the commercial realities these days is that if you're a young person with no track record, and your landlord is going to do a check on you to determine whether you are, call it, worthy of leasing your property out to, and he deems or she deems it not so, then they are going to ask for suretyship agreements to be put in place for, like in this example you mentioned, the parents. I would then suggest and advise to the parents that they need to scrutinize that suretyship agreement to see what the extent of their liability will be.
Nazir, surety agreements normally are standard. I don't think you are placed in the position to negotiate on what's the content of that surety. Is that correct?
No, that is so, Israel, but sometimes there will be a limit in terms of the amount of surety that you will be liable for. So, for example, the parents can say, we'll be a surety to a maximum of, call it, as for discussion, 10,000 Rand, and nothing over and above that, and you know your extent is limited to 10,000. But in practice, that doesn't always happen. And like Faisal mentioned now, the landlord or the creditor in the scenario can choose against who he's going to go and collect his rental from, whether he's going to go against the principal debtor, who in this case is the youngster, or whether he's going to go against the parents as the sureties, or both. And that's the reality. You open yourself up for litigation in the event that the principal debtor doesn't perform.
Okay, so bottom line is, if you can avoid a surety, then please avoid that surety. Don't sign things that you that's going to bite you later on. And the bad thing about signing a surety sometimes is that the person who signed surety did not have the option to pay it in installments. The full amount becomes due and payable normally. Faisal?
The balance is outstanding.
The full balance becomes outstanding and they must pay.
The full balance, yeah.
I just want to mention one more thing, Ikshan, just on this, if I may. It's also in the suretyship agreement, there will also be what we call a domicilium address that the surety selects. 6 months later, they move from that address and they don't notify the creditor. Judgments can be taken against you without you knowing in instances like
that. Well, that happens very often.
Very often. And people come for credit checks and they see there's a judgment against the name and they don't know anything about it. So just be certain that if you do move your premises or your service address, that you notify your creditors.
Yeah, lots of people think if you move, then you're never going to see the debt again. And that's not the reality. Now, sometimes, and I mean, part of our topic is the sharks. Now, of course, sometimes people will come to you with a deal that you can't believe. It just sounds too good to be true. Now, what is the rule? When the deal sounds too good to be true,
it probably is.
Yeah. So go ahead. It's like, just examine some of these deals that people come with. They're going to double your money. They can buy this and they can give you this type of return. What should the person, the potential investor, do at that point in time? What is his due diligence?
Well, I think first, before just jumping into any investment, you need to do some research. Like you said, due diligence. Try to establish the history of the company that is offering this 100% return or 200% return. Mm-hmm. So go back into the history.
Now, Faisal, I'm making a very bad example by calling it 100%. I would say if anybody offers you anything in excess of 10%, it's already too good to be true. Little as that.
Yeah. So when you're going to do that type of investment. So do your homework and check out the place. Now, you must understand, when people come to you and they explain to you these investments, these people are normally trained in marketing.
Mm-hmm.
So when they got the skills of marketing, they will talk to you and they will paint this rosy picture as, what type of profits you could generate out of this investment. And it all sounds good, it sounds nice, and you get excited. And they don't normally talk about the pitfalls or the shortcomings of these type of investments. And if you don't ask the questions, you're never going to know if you're too overexcited. So that's the first thing. So investigate the company and see if there's a track record. And normally you'll be able to establish that that information quite easily. And then speak to people also about it. Find out from people, do you hear about this company? Did you invest in this company before? What was your experience with this company? You could obviously check the internet out also and see if there's some bad publicity around the company. So there's a few things that you personally can do, and then if you're still not 100% sure, you can get other people to do some research for you. That's on investments. There's also other things where with immovable property, where people are put in trouble with their property, and the bank is breathing down their neck and they're threatening foreclosure, and then you get all of a sudden these companies or
so-called
persons
investors
coming out and they're going to save your property, but you might just sign on the dotted line. And normally what happens, you are transferring the property out of your name and they promise that you can buy back the company. So be very careful about those transactions.
I want to examine that a little bit more, because that happens very, very often. And I think, Nazir, you've also had a lot of experience with that.
Live from Cape Town, this is the Voice of the Cape. The Voice of the Cape. The Voice of the
Legal Hour with Ihsan Higgins.
Mm-hmm.
we are back with the Legal Hour with Ihsan Higgins here, and of course we have Nasir Parker and Faisal Bardin in studio. We're talking about deals that go bad, we're talking about sharks, we're talking about businesses. At the moment we're talking about people that fall into arrears, and suddenly somebody knocks on their door, and this person says, you know what, I can save your property. Of course, you're going to have a sigh of relief, and you're thinking this person is now going to write out a check and save the day. But that's not always the case. Nasir, can you just take us through what's a normal scenario?
Well, Hassan, unfortunately, at the time that this incident plays out, you're already in a vulnerable position because you fear that you're going to lose your property and the banks are going to foreclose on the property. Then when you have this hand that's extended from a complete stranger and saying that I'm going to save your property, you begin to grasp it with both hands. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, the situations that plays out nowadays is that these, call it investors, buys the property for literally next to nothing, not even close to market value. And they reassure the owners that they will be able to buy it back from them at a small markup. And the owners agree because they think in 4, 5, or 6 months' time their financial positions will change. And lo and behold, at 6 months down the line, the previous owners now are faced with eviction applications, losing the property in any event, and the property gets sold to a third party for a profit by these investors. So these people aren't always what they make themselves out to be. And I think Faisal's points early on are doing your due diligence and checking all the T's are crossed and all the I's are dotted is extremely important.
So when this happens, Faisal, wouldn't it be prudent then for the person who's obviously in this vulnerable position to tell that person, okay, can we go to a lawyer of my choice? You pay for the lawyer, seeing that you obviously now, and you can add that to your markup at the end of it and see if that person is going to bite.
Yeah, look, my experience is, because I've dealt with these type of situations and the proposals that has been put forward to the property owner. So normally they would say they got their own firm of attorneys. Mm-hmm. These are the people who are proposing the transaction to you, and their firm of attorneys will give you the information or the contracts that you must sign, etc., etc. So when that client came to me and said, listen, here's, this is my situation, and here's the information that I received from this company who's going to rescue me because financially he needed some money. And then I said, okay, let's do because he thought they're just going to give him the money and he's going to repay the money at a later stage, either when he sells the property or mortgages the property, whatever the case may be. And then on close investigation, when the information was given to the client and I made contact with the other parties on the other side and specifically asked the question, with the transaction, is the property going to remain in the owner's name or must the property be transferred out of the owner's name into the new entity's name? And they confirmed that no, it must be transferred out of the entity, out of the owner's name, the property. And then there's a buyback type of scenario, you know. So initially, the people who promotes or sells this transaction or this deal to the property owners do not mention that. They do not mention that the property must be transferred out of the owner's name. So in other words, it's like they're selling their property.
Yes, they're selling it for a silly price.
A silly price, exactly. Mm-hmm. And that silly price just about covers the bond, you know, so the bank is off your neck. But before you thinking I'm getting rid of the bank, you're actually getting rid of your equity in that property.
In the property, yes. So that's also one of the examples. And of course, then the other big one is the powers of attorney. You know, where people give others a power of attorney over the whatever it is, whether it's special power of attorney or general power of attorney. Maybe you guys can just take us through the special power of attorney and the general power of attorney, and when is it appropriate to hand that power of attorney over to someone?
Maybe I can just illustrate or just explain the different scenarios first, and then Nasir can get more into detail. The one, if you want to give somebody a special or a general power of attorney. You might be living abroad and working abroad, but you got some assets here, maybe you got a house here, and you give the power of attorney to somebody you trust and say, listen, you manage the house for me, you collect the rent, you pay the water, you pay the municipal account, you fix whatever breaks, and you know, that type of arrangement. The power of attorney is there. That person who gives you the power of attorney is of sound mind at the point in time, and that's fine. So you can use it, and that power of attorney can be cancelled by that person at any given time. That's the one scenario. The other scenario is that the person is not of sound mind, you know. Then you have to approach the courts, and a curator bonus and a curator persona must be appointed to look after that person's fair, welfare and the person's assets and finances. And then the last one is obviously a letters of executorship, whereby a person has passed away and that person then takes care of the assets and the finances of that estate.
So Nazir, you find a lot of people, you know, handing, like Faisal said now, signing over power of attorney to another person. Does that put the person into the shoes of that person signing that power of attorney over?
It does, Hassan. Especially, well, it depends on the whether there's any limitations that's stipulated in the power of attorney. But if it's just a general power of attorney, like Faisal used the example of somebody that's overseas, you effectively becoming that person's next or shadow.
It sounds very dangerous.
It is extremely. For the person that's overseas and might not be knowing what's going on over here, anything could be happening. In general power of attorney, people could be selling properties. you wouldn't even know it because he's got the authority to do that. It's the relationship of the principal and the agent at the end of the day. So if you are going to intend or give somebody power of attorney over your assets or whatever it is, just make sure that the person is trustworthy and that you have possible limitations in place. For I'm not the biggest promoter of a general power of attorney, I must be honest. I normally just like the special power of attorneys for a specific purpose.
But there's also something that Faisal, at what point does the power of attorney terminate? In other words, where that person can't act on your behalf anymore?
Well, like I said, the person who issues or gives the power of attorney, he or she can cancel that power of attorney at any given time and immediately. So that person who has the power of attorney cannot act on that power of attorney. Because I've seen the situation with regard to immovable property. So if you have a power of attorney and that person cancel the power of attorney, but you still act on that power of attorney, then you possibly create or committing a criminal offense, because you are now continuing using the power of attorney to sell the property, to transfer the property, and to receive the proceeds of that sale. You know, depending on what you do with that proceeds.
Okay, but there's also another scenario. If somebody signed a power of attorney over to a third party, then that person then becomes of unsound mind, the ill, and they can't, of course, understand the nature of transactions. Then surely that power of attorney is no longer applicable.
Yes, that would be the case, because now you need a curator bonus and a curator persona to be appointed. So only while you have sound mind that power of attorney can be applicable.
You agree, Nazir?
I agree, Hassan. I think that there might be a little bit of grey area there, you know, to determine whether the power of attorney, when it was granted, the person of sound mind does now, even now, no longer being of sound mind anymore, automatically terminated.
Because you find a lot of scenarios where somebody had signed a power of attorney, but they may be bedridden, and I mean, we get approached a lot as lawyers to say, no, this person is in bed, you know, we need a power of attorney. And then, of course, as an ethical lawyer, one should actually be very circumspect in drafting such a document and saying to that person, wait, you can't, I'm not just going to draft the document, I want to see the person. Because it's one thing just to say to the person, sign there, and the person don't understand the nature of that signature. And I mean, and that would essentially be an illegal act. But how do you prove it?
Well, that's the thing. It's going to become a question of medical evidence, I think, at the end of the day, whether that person was of sound mind, could understand the nature and consequence of his or her actions at the time that he was executing the document. I think it'll become a full-blown medical investigation, and then it will probably end up in experts coming to testify at court if there is that kind of litigation flowing from it.
I think when there is, you know, maybe the person who is giving this power of attorney and the person acting on the power of attorney, and there's no other parties, you know, around. So if that person's mental state changes, and nobody, you know, informs the court that mental status has changed, and it's very difficult because this person who's got the power of attorney is not going to disclose it and continues acting and doing as he pleases. However, I think it's the duty of the family, maybe, or the duty of institutions who are, you know, confronted with this situation to speak out about it and say, listen, this person cannot longer act in terms of the power of attorney. The person must be acting in terms of a curatorship. And remember, when the courts appoint the curators, they are normally qualified people to be able to act in that capacity, whether it's a curator bonus or a curator persona, because there's a process involved. And the process entails for a curator ad litem to do an investigation and then to do a recommendation to the High Court to say, yes, this scenario, you know, makes provision for a curator bonus to be appointed and a curator persona to be appointed. You know, so there's supposed to be qualified people who are supposed to take care of that person's assets and that person's well-being compared to a person, anybody just having a power of attorney. You know, and,
yeah,
and the possibility of squandering those assets are much greater, I think.
So I think people must just be very circumspect. I mean, on the one hand, people must be vigilant, you know, if they enter into a particular contract, that they must enter into the appropriate contract for that particular purpose. So the one thing that you didn't mention, companies, shareholders' agreements. I mean, surely that document governs the rights of all shareholders.
Yeah, what is important, you know, when we spoke about the PTY Limited, the private company, there are directors appointed, and then you have a shareholders who own the shares. So if there's 100 shares that has been authorized and there's 100 issued shares, we're not going to get into the nitty-gritty about that, but those shares, that 100 shares, get split amongst the shareholders. So if there is maybe 5 shareholders and each one get 20 shares, that makes up the 100 shareholding. And you need a shareholders agreement to basically record the shareholding of that shareholders. And also you have share certificates that gets issued, and you have a share register that also, at date of registration of the company and the issue of the shares, records all these details as such. Because remember, it's the shareholders of the company who appoints and can remove directors of the company. And directors are basically people who work for the company and, you know, manage the company as such, like trustees who manage a trust.
Unfortunately, that is going to be all the time where, I mean, would have loved to have gone into some more contracts, and especially, you know, where people are prejudiced. But so for the listeners, there's certain contracts that you must enter into, that you're encouraged to enter into. And I think the new thing that came out tonight, I mean, from putting the three legal heads together, is even spouses that are only married Islamically, if you own a joint property or a few joint properties, it may be a good idea to enter into a partnership agreement. Even if you have been owners of that property for many, many years, it will just cause less heartache if anything happens, if somebody dies, if there's a divorce. And then, of course, you know, the issue of the partnership is already sorted out, you know, before anything else. On the issue of certain contracts that you need to be circumspect about, you know, things like the suretyships, cession agreements. I don't think we dealt with cession agreements tonight. But we'll do it at another time because we don't have any time left. And, of course, the issue of the powers of attorney. You know, to be very, very careful or what type of documents you allow somebody to act on your behalf. So those are some of the issues that we've dealt with tonight. There's many, and I know there's been many questions as well, which I didn't get to. I don't know why the time went so quick tonight.
Yeah, I think we need to extend the program if possible, Ihsan, because there was something else I wanted to also, you know, speak about, which is cyber crime, which is also affecting our individuals and businesses. But that we can maybe add to the next
program. In fact, while we were sitting here, I just saw an email coming from the Law Society that people are scamming, you know, saying to people, let's say you're about to pay someone, and then of course they intercept that and they send you a different account detail, and then you just pay. And the courts have actually now said it's your duty to make sure that it's the right account.
Yes, no, of course, yeah. And just a figure, the figure in South Africa, the cyber crime amounts to about 5.8 billion a year.
A year, 5.8 billion.
Yes.
Aina.
So it's a huge amount, and there's such a lot of different.
No, then we definitely need to maybe continue this program and maybe deal with you know, some of the issues pertaining to cyber crime, especially with, in fact, even with individuals, not just businesses. Mm. So Faisal, just your details quickly.
Yeah, I'm in Claremont, and my office number is 021 683 3553.
Nazir?
Contactable in 021 224 0071.
And you are in
Athlone.
And the Legal Cafe number, people can, if you have any more questions, and I know there's been a few questions, please send that same questions through to the Legal Cafe number. We'll try to answer it on the Legal Cafe WhatsApp on 082-336-3778. Number 082-336-3778. And that's unfortunately all we have time for tonight on the Legal Hour. I just want to say from my side, Faisal and Nazir's side, that we wish to say shukran to the community for allowing us to serve this community. So from my side, till next week, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
The Legal Hour with Ihsan Higgins.